So, welcome to The Aphorists. I'm Jesse Holding, I'm with Anthony Ryan, and this is episode 2 of our podcast, where we talk about a variety of topics. Sometimes it's art, sometimes it's driving and pedestrians and bicyclists and living in the city. We try to offer a variety of viewpoints, or just two viewpoints at least, and Anthony and I...
A variety of two.
Our first topic today is the recent article in the
Wired magazine?
No, I was thinking about the San Francisco magazine. That's the San Francisco magazine where talking about how much the title is "How Much Tech Can One City Take." It's by David Talbot, who founded
Salon.com,
and he talks about how.
Hey Jesse, can we run down our list of topics first? Do you want to do that?
Yeah, maybe we just start
Gabfest style.
Gabfest style. The most organized podcast on the internet.
Are you being sarcastic?
No, they are the most organized. They just get right to it, don't they?
So today we'll be talking about...
How much tech can one city take? We'll be talking about the infographic that good folks over at Stamen put together, visualizing the private bus networks of Silicon Valley. And we will be
talking... And a blog post on human transit.
Oh, yeah.
Some interesting points about statements.
Right.
Anyway, sorry.
And we'll be also talking about...
rideshare services.
Right, yep. And some of the California vehicle codes and pedestrian codes that govern how we interact in the city streets.
Excellent. So this is all about urban transit.
This is our urban transit episode. Mm. I thought that How Much Tech Can One City Take article was actually pretty, we'll put a link up on our website, was pretty interesting. I mean, basically he's making the point that, the mayor, Ed Lee, is having these weekly meetings with the, tech industry leadership, mm-hmm. And working out ways to keep, and this focuses around Twitter, but other tech industries or tech companies within the borders of San Francisco.
So we should note the irony present here that Ed Lee started his political career. First of all, he's the son of, I don't know if his parents
restaurateurs in I think in Seattle or mm-hmm. up north.
But he started out as a tenants' rights activist
right.
in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So he is getting some pushback from the progressive mm-hmm. Element in San Francisco.
Right.
Because this emphasis on tech and tech workers is pushing out, you name it, artists, mm-hmm. People of color.
Just anybody with
who's
like
not,
a moderate income
doesn't have the
right.
money that these people have.
Right, right.
Rents are soaring.
Yep.
Et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious, like, what's the balance between finding the tax base to continue to support the kinds of initiatives that San Francisco has always supported, like, homeless, needle exchanges, all those kinds of things that make San Francisco a very tolerant city, and a considerate city, I guess. Mm-hmm. A humanitarian city, maybe, is the way to say it. If the payroll tax is, so the company Twitter cites the payroll tax as a reason to move. They're going to double their, or almost more than double, I think it was 450 going to 1,000
employees. Was that the sole reason they cited for the...
That was the primary reason, that the payroll tax was the primary reason that they wanted to move out of San Francisco, so...
So Ed Lee is floating with, we should say, the support of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and labor, which is
right.
strong,
mm-hmm.
has a lot of political clout in San Francisco, is supporting his move to... Tax corporations based on gross receipts versus
payroll.
Versus payroll. And I honestly don't know enough about that issue. To know
right. Or not. I mean, I think...
But I will push back on something you just said, which is, like, this idea that... you didn't actually pose it in these sharp terms, but this idea, I think the article stated, I think it was Dave Eggers, actually a quote by Dave Eggers saying, this influx of money, you know, the upside is that it helps the city pay for all... you know, the expensive infrastructure that the city requires.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just would push back on that. I just think that's sort of a false choice there. Because I think there's no shortage of wealth in San Francisco already.
Right.
So on two levels, it's like, you know, yeah, you have a city with, you know, just peppered with, you know, $1 and $2 million homes. Mm-hmm. And... you know, the streets in front of them are falling apart. So what's right. going on there? Something's already right. going on there. And, you know, furthermore, like, who's to say just because there's this influx of wealth that that's going to result in a stronger tax base?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not... You know, as I said, rich people, people with money have a tendency to
hang on to
figure out how to hold on to it.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. yeah, I mean, I guess, so it's like a two-part question. Like, the... To go back to the original point of the payroll tax, you know, the criticism of payroll taxes or taxes in general, corporate tax, what have you, and this is at a national level or a local level, you know, one way of looking at taxes is to say you tax something you want to discourage, right? So raise the tax cigarettes because you don't want people to smoke. Tax soft drinks like Bloomberg did in New York.
Income because you don't want people to work.
But then there's that's the flip side of that is like you don't tax income because you don't want people to work. That logic only goes so far, right?
Mm-hmm. Whose logic is that, by the way?
Well, I mean, I heard it on Econ Talk, Russ Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
So libertarian viewpoint. Mm-hmm. Well, but how economists talk about taxes is basically the idea of a tax is that you tax something that you want to curb. Or that's one way home taxes ownership. Function. Well, there's the taxable. Yeah, no, it's not an aphorism. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's an aphorism. It is kind of
what's an aphorism?
It's so
a statement that sounds truthful, but is
well, it's a it's a
lighter
it's
than air.
No, it's a true statement. It's mm-hmm. a concise true statement. Is an aphorism is a concise true statement. Whatever truth means.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can see in action potentially. So Twitter leaving because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to, for every employee that they hire, they don't want to have to pay a tax per head. Basically, mm-hmm. they'd rather say, leave the number of employees that I have up to me and I'll just pay you a percentage of our gross receipts. Mm-hmm. So that's a, if their workforce fluctuates, and their bottom line stays the same, then it's a net, you know, even for them, right? I mean, they're paying, like, let's say they have 450 employees and they want to add 100 employees, but that doesn't affect their bottom line. Their gross receipts stay the same, then that, you know, it's a predictable amount of money for them in terms of running their business. And then if they shed 50 employees, you know,
That can't be their sole incentive for that move, though.
To move out of San Francisco?
Yeah.
I mean, if that's how they portray it, we can't, you know, I can't know there.
But also, there are so many other factors involved, though. Like, clearly, and getting back to the topic of transit, clearly they've decided that, you know, presumably Twitter would move to, what, San Mateo County? Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, basically.
Right, right.
I imagine, since they're already in San Francisco... Their employees mainly live in San Francisco.
Right.
So they're going to go the bus route, which gets to our other topic. So
right.
they're going to have
the exodus.
Shuttle services. Right. Either that or their employees are going to have to drive down the peninsula. So they're going to further burden that infrastructure.
Right.
So, like, basically, I would say that move is incentivized on a lot of different levels, by the state of California's decision to invest in an extensive network of freeways
right
to the south, the total lack of regulation of these sort of corporate transit services that operate, you know, across these different counties.
Right.
I would say it's probably further incentivized by probably, I don't know what the taxes are like, corporate taxes are like in San Mateo County.
Yeah, no idea.
But I imagine it's less than in San Francisco.
Right. And well, they certainly don't have an employee, they don't have a payroll tax, right? So.
Yeah, I don't believe they do. Yeah, so, but it's the classic arithmetic of like, well, city of San Francisco has this extensive infrastructure, transit infrastructure, on and on and on, that it needs to pay for. So we, being a totally self-serving corporate citizen, are going to move to a neighboring county that has relatively little infrastructure to support, therefore it does not required to, you know, isn't required.
It's like the Emeryville situation, right?
The Emeryville situation we talked about, all these big box stores move in next to Oakland. Oakland is deprived of all that tax revenue, and the citizens of Oakland go and
spend their
pay 8% of all their purchases at IKEA and freaking Home Depot and everything else.
Right.
Or Tacoma Home Depot. Like, we just recently got a Lowe's in San Francisco. It took freaking forever.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it's just that whole sort of, you know, corporate flight, corporate exodus. It's really funny because I was reminded of this book that I read many years ago, and we'll put a link to the Google Book version of this. But it's City, Rediscovering the Center by William H. White, published in 1988. And I remember reading this. I remember reading this in the library at SUNY Purchase way back in the day. But there's a whole chapter about the exodus of all these corporations from Midtown Manhattan to the suburbs.
Right.
And this exodus occurred in the 50s and 60s when arguably New York City was in this rapid state of decline.
Right.
The infrastructure was outdated, rising crime, et cetera, et cetera. And the author of this book did this research and found this correlation between, I guess the corporation's argument at the time was that a lot of their employees already lived in the suburbs, so they were actually making it more convenient for their employees. And like,
right.
If you worked here, you'd be at work already, I guess, logic.
Yeah, totally.
but they actually charted that, you know, a lot of people had to leave their jobs because their company moved to, you know, Fairfield or Danbury, Connecticut, or White Plains, New York. And
so it'd be a commute from Manhattan out into the suburbs.
Yeah. Sense. So people either had to relocate or they had to quit. And the other thing the author did was they found this correlation between the location of the CEO's and board of directors' homes and the new corporate headquarters.
No way.
So basically these guys decided, IBM, Union Carbide was an example, all these other companies decided to basically move their corporate headquarters within, you know, spitting different distance of the CEO's homes.
That's wild.
It'd be interesting to do a parallel study with, like, CEO of Twitter.
Yeah.
Or, like, does he live in San Francisco?
Yeah, it's a good question.
So anyway.
Yeah.
I'll let you go back to your
point. No, that's interesting. How do you balance what happens in a city, both in terms of like the industries, so tech industry or what have you, service, obviously. I remember reading about or listening on, maybe it was the Planet Money. I was talking about how, and this is relevant to San Francisco, how there's been a sort of not in my backyard attitude towards building high, tall residential buildings. Part of the reason that housing is so expensive in San Francisco, or one of the reasons housing is so expensive,
is the NIMBY element.
Is that no one wants a high rise. That you know, there's a cap put on how high you can build in San Francisco. And so that, like, you know, I guess the zoning downtown is that you can go at a certain height, but like once you get outside of the main downtown area, you can't build very high, and therefore all residential housing becomes very expensive.
There's this double lot around the corner from my house that live at 26th and Mission, which is a high density area and prime for it's very close to BART. Like, mm-hmm. transit's great. And
right.
Like,
yeah. You're in the Cesar Chavez corridor down.
Yeah.
280 and all that.
Right. It's very accessible to the freeway to Silicon Valley, too, which is part of the reason that Mission District is so impacted by the growth of Silicon Valley, as it's become more livable and less of a ghetto, so to speak. But, like, I actually have no factual basis for this, but there's an apartment building on BART.
I
really, it won't stop me. You're Mr. Fact, I'm Mr. Anecdote here. You know, like, so, but there's this double lot around the corner. It used to have a single family home on it that probably predates, like, all the other buildings in that area. Mm-hmm. Well, it burned down, maybe. I've lived there close to 10 years. This must be 8 years ago. It burned down. That lot has been empty ever since. It's prime location.
Right.
I mean, in the time that it's been there, like, there have been condo buildings sprouting up, like, you know, mushrooms everywhere.
Right.
They can't get anything built on this. And my suspicion is that on the property line, on the other side, there's this apartment building that's probably, like, built in the 1920s, really nice sort of craftsman style to probably, like, I bet it's like a 6-unit apartment building.
Right.
And they have, like, window exposure on the property line.
Mm-hmm.
And my suspicion is that those people are holding up.
Right.
Whatever. These hearings that have to be held.
Right.
I have to attend the next hearing.
Yeah, you definitely
actually post it for the next hearing.
Right. You should do that. I'd be interested.
Because clearly, like, the building of anything over 2 stories adjacent to their property
would
cut off. They probably have a nice view of Bernal Heights looking south, plus the southern exposure, so they get
good
a lot
light.
Of light through it.
So.
But, this burns me to no end, because I feel like if you want to control your environment that much, then move to the fucking suburbs.
Right.
It's a city.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole point. Housing density is the point of a city.
Exactly.
You know, I've had to learn this myself, because, like, I live downstairs from, like, noisy neighbors. And, like, you know what? When you live in an apartment building with people upstairs, you're going to hear them, period.
Right. Yeah.
You just have to live with that.
Yeah. And they're going to feed the birds off their balcony.
Aha, I think I got them to stop that.
Did you really?
So my upstairs neighbors was just like, I mean, pigeons. It was nice at first because, like, no, it attracted songbirds at first.
Oh, did
he
it?
Just got,
right.
Well, he just got this bug up his ass to just start feeding birds.
Yeah.
And so it started slowly driving me nuts. You know, first I took my, like, oh, I'll go with the flow. It's like I have to clean up a little bird seed and some feathers. But then, like, on other occasions, I'd see him just literally throw a bucket of birdseed out into the parking lot, lot behind her. So, like, the pigeons proliferated. They all roost now on the building opposite.
Oh.
And they wait for him to put the seed out.
Gotcha.
I'm cleaning up birdseed and bird shit. And, like, basically my deck off the back of my apartment is the bottom of a birdcage.
Must be pleasant.
So, like, this guy, I've had confrontations with this guy in the past, so I didn't want to, like, go to the door and be like, stop fucking feeding the pigeons, asshole. So I started various passive-aggressive attacks. Yeah. Like, I would print out the city ordinance against feeding pigeons door, which he defaced and tore down.
That's so great.
Finally, I, like, put in some complaints to the health department, and the other day I posted, like, the full, like, webpage from the health department about not feeding pigeons. It attracts rodents, and pigeons carry disease that are harmful to humans, blah, 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 blah. And, like, basically, like, if you will be compelled, if pigeons start to roost on your building, you actually, they do this with graffiti, too. You will be compelled at your own expense to remediate the problem.
Right.
Whether it's putting up netting
or
whatever.
Those, like, spiky things,
spiky things.
Oh, really? So, what's the graffiti rule?
Graffiti rule is, as a homeowner, you are responsible to remove graffiti from your building.
Really?
Huh. And if you don't do it, you'll be fined.
Really?
Which is one of the things that burns me about graffiti culture, is that they don't really get that they think they're sticking it to the man, maybe.
Right.
You know, they're sticking it to, like, the 70-year-old that has to get up on a ladder and paint out
the
side of their building.
Yeah.
So, anyway, they do the same thing. So the city's basically putting the burden of that kind of maintenance
on the homeowner.
So anyway, I think he stopped feeding the pigeons.
Oh, good.
Nice. It's been like 3 days, and I don't have any bird seed on my deck.
Nicely done, sir. Those ordinances, those rules are great.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
If they're followed,
mm-hmm.
It's my pet peeve rules, going back to the city, I mean to living in the city, is the crosswalk, the pedestrian rules, the like the countdown this is my old rant, right?
So are you gonna, because this was on a previous recording, but this that maybe you won't see the light of day.
It may not see the light of day, but so it's the
okay. Everybody, right, get ready. Right, I'll do the intro. So, this is Jesse's major pet peeve against pedestrians in urban settings. Okay, Jesse.
So the background is, I mean, we all as drivers, we all experience this, and so the countdown. It's like, especially on Market downtown, there's the countdown timer. So it's, you get the green, you know, you get the go ahead to walk. It's the white walk person, right? And then it starts.
Put on I'm going to listen to some music while you're doing that. No, no.
So then the countdown goes, and then that's the, and then you have the chance for to take a right from Market onto Second or New Montgomery, whatever it is. But people perceive that
you know
they
my solution.
What's your solution?
Don't take a right.
It's such a retarded
solution.
You can't
take a left either.
It's like you never get anywhere, right? I mean, your solution is like, don't drive downtown is like also not great. Because what if you have to drive downtown? I mean, tons of people have to drive downtown. Anyway.
Well,
but,
you know, that's
so,
another topic. Because like some, you know, London, to drive in the city center in London,
you have to pay congestion pricing. I'm all for congestion pricing. I really am. I think that's a great solution. Manhattan does it too, right?
You know, I saw a quote by Michael Bloomberg recently, arch socialist.
Yes.
Who said in cities, public transit should be free.
Yeah.
And it should cost to drive a car.
Yeah. I'm done totally deal. Done. I'm done. Agreed.
But isn't that a problem?
We just shook hands.
Because that's like, then like driving becomes the purview of an elite that can pay for it.
Totally.
Which I suppose is already the case.
It's already the case.
Like I've noticed for a long time, like people, you know, like you'll often see like people with like super expensive cars that just park wherever the fuck they want.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the thing.
Somebody else pays a ticket for them, I guess. I don't.
Yeah, that was the, in that that San Francisco magazine thing saying that like people just parking Range Rovers up on the sidewalk and collecting tickets because they could afford it.
Well, that's always been historically the cheapest ticket. Although I think they've upped them. They definitely upped them.
Right.
I mean, it used to be a $25 ticket.
Is that right? I mean, that's just obnoxious to the whatever. I mean, I just say tow it, you know?
I should just tow it. Although it can be hard to get access to tow it.
Right. Forklift. Lift it up on a forklift.
Can I tell a short story?
Please do.
I used to live over at like 17th and Dolores. So, and I had the 72 Datsun 510.
Mm-hmm.
Well, piece of shit.
Nice.
I loved that car. Yeah. It was great. It was yellow. It had an orange stripe.
Of course. They all came that way, right?
Really hard to park over there. I mean, just coming home late one night. I don't know if you've ever done this where you like squeeze into a spot without noticing that you're actually in a driveway.
No.
So I squeeze, like literally like, you know, the like parallel park with
right,
like.
Right, right. It's a 72 point parallel park.
Yes,
right,
exactly.
Right.
And I go out in the morning and normally they would tell if it was
blocking
a
driveway.
This
yeah.
is like a freaking apartment building.
Oh too. My God, Anthony.
And I think I had like a $50 ticket, but they couldn't get the hook on my car, so they weren't able to tow it.
Just because you were bumper to bumper.
Because I was bumper to bumper.
That is awesome. Well met, sir. I know you must have felt actually pretty bad about that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm like,
you know,
it's
I was talking
that
to,
you won't notice.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's late at night. It's dark, whatever.
Yeah.
I was talking to a friend who lives in the Mission. We were talking about getting back and forth to the studio, and she was saying, "Oh, I can't stay at the studio too late because I have to get a parking spot before 7 p.m."
Oh yeah, I've lived that.
And it's just so like, you know, you really live your life around traffic around here. Like I plan my studio
parking.
Well, parking and traffic. I mean, I get up at I do this because I'm also productive in the morning, but part of the reason, I know I never sleep in the morning because I leave from Oakland and drive to San Francisco where our studio is, because I don't want to sit in traffic. I don't want to sit in the metering lights to get over here. Now, obviously, I have the choice of not having a studio in San Francisco, but that's where my studio is. You know, I prefer to live in the East Bay, over San Francisco for a variety of reasons. Among them, how much sun we get. The other, the crazy people out in front of the house problem.
You prefer to have crazy?
No. I prefer not to have crazy like you do. Like that, you're a Led Zeppelin guy. Like I just couldn't deal with that. I don't think.
I want to know more about that.
Okay.
At some point.
So yeah, I mean, so I organize my life more or less around not sitting in traffic, and then people organize their lives around getting home. I mean, they're driving. So Alana drives to multiple teaching jobs.
Yeah,
and so she really has to have a car. She can't. She couldn't do it in public transportation.
Well, I'm in the same boat, and Mike Ryan is too.
Yeah,
we're adjuncts at various different places.
And yeah, like,
neither of us own a car.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think she has three different. She teaches at three different colleges. So I mean, whatever. Maybe it's different for different people, right?
I'm saying I don't think it's possible, right?
Yeah, it's not a requirement that she parked it, right?
Right. But, well, like I just applied for a job at College of Marin.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I might have to figure something out there. That's in Kentfield.
Right. It's hard. You'd be spending a lot of time on the train. Can you even get there?
I think I'd have to take a Golden Gate Transit bus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had that great post not too long ago on Facebook where you and Sarah took the train, like a train out to a bus, and then like went out to the Marin Headlands. You basically did this. You were proselytizing for
Point Reyes, actually.
Evangelizing for you went to Point Reyes. That's right. Evangelizing for like the possibility of having fun on the weekend using. Getting there via public transport. Yeah.
It's fun. Yeah, it is really fun.
Yeah.
Like, we ended up, that was a great trip. So, like, basically you go to Marin City, mm-hmm. which is just south of Mill Valley, right over the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
On one bus. It's the 70. And then there's something called the West Marin Stage.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually two of them. One leaves from there, and another one if you go to San Rafael, which you can also get a bus connection there.
Yeah.
That one goes out Sir Francis Drake.
Right.
So the one we took goes out.
What's the one I've gotten stuck behind when I'm driving out to go surfing?
It's Stimson?
Bolinas. Yeah, Bolinas.
Yeah, like, that's the South Marin Stage.
Gotcha.
And it goes
really slow. It goes really slow.
It goes really slow. It goes over Panoramic Highway down to Bolinas. To Stimson and then Bolinas.
Yeah.
Downtown Bolinas.
That's funny.
And that's just like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. We literally just, like, take the bus from freaking 7th and Market.
Yeah.
And then we step off the bus.
At the beach.
In the country.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the great things about this area, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a car, you can drive to a very remote place, but just to be able to take public transport to one of those places is pretty remarkable.
It's such close
proximity to the city.
There is something about not driving that just mm-hmm. gives me a lot of peace. I can't explain it. Even just getting to work, like getting out to state and having to park and stuff.
Right.
Like, I just feel better. I don't mean to sound all self-righteous.
No.
But it's like, I just feel better. In the way you feel better when you start your day, like, hitting the ground running and being productive and getting shit done.
You know,
folding the laundry and all that stuff. Like,
sure.
For me, it's almost part and parcel with that.
Right.
Yeah. And, like, even to where, like, you know, the other day I was reading up about the Koch brothers, you know, like, we mm-hmm. hear so much about them. And then I realized, well, you know, so all those guys' money come from their development of these new technologies of oil extraction.
Oh, is that right?
And that's where their money comes from.
Huh.
So, like, if we're voting with our pocketbook, voting with your wallet,
right,
in this election, then we're all, like, by driving, we're voting for, and again, I'm not, everyone drives, man, I get it.
Yeah.
I'm not being self-righteous here, but, like, how much money have you spent on gas? Have you spent on gas this year versus how much have you contributed to Barack Obama's campaign or,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, so. I just feel like
I have contributed to Barack Obama's campaign. I have not contributed as much as I have to the 76 on Grand Avenue. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And
for sure.
So, yeah, it might all balance out there.
Yeah.
But I guess, like, that's always a strong component for me. Like, I feel like your economic activity is inevitably part of your participation in the democracy, especially in light of Citizens United and, like, unlimited spending.
I completely agree with that.
All this conservative money, the reason people have money is because the way things are set up right now is exactly how they want them.
Right.
Yeah, it's working for them. And they want to sustain that as long as they can.
Sure.
I just heard, who's this guy who's like, I was just re-listening to an old Bill Maher Real Time.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is an ex-GM executive. I can't recall his name right now. But I had actually missed this when I heard the first interview because I re-listen to that show sometimes. But he was basically like, well, you're an arch, Bill Maher saying, you're an arch capitalist, you know, like, how does it feel having your industry bailed out by the government? You're a socialist now, huh?
Right.
And this guy literally said, this is what he said. The reason the auto industry was on the verge of being bankrupt, is due to decades of regulation by the government that destroyed their business model. I assume he's talking about CAFE standards, gas mileage standards.
Maybe.
So it's only fair that the government should bail them out.
It's a very interesting perspective.
That is freaking insane. I mean, they made an inferior project or product for like four decades.
Right.
And that's why they lost their market share.
Right.
You know, and like,
so I wonder, and, like, you know, what regulations is, like, you know, safety UAW standards, but safety standards or CAFE standards? I mean,
I don't know.
Or
he didn't, both, he didn't press
right.
on it.
But well, I mean, like, the safety standards one would be just ridiculous, right? Because, I mean,
well, I guess in his ideal world, yeah, there's no regulation of gas mileage standards. There's no regulations for safety. There's probably also protectionist trade policies in place.
There's absolutely protect. I mean,
there already are.
There already are, but they
want more draconian trade.
Well, and they just filed that claim against China for their, for lowering, for making cars too inexpensive. So it doesn't. We don't compete. We're not competing with China in any real way.
Yeah.
There is protectionism there. I don't remember there was a recent thing up on Planet Money about that. That was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put a link up on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's,
I'll
you
link
know,
to the real time podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you can only get it through iTunes.
Is that right? Yeah, no, it is bizarre. And I guess, you know, I read an interesting article that said basically that, you know, all of the, and this is happening with solar, but electric cars, all of the green, quote unquote, green technologies, they're losing traction daily as new gas extraction techniques continue to make gas petroleum product extraction more and more efficient locally. So the United States is now less dependent on, or is becoming less dependent on foreign oil, and then we can also get oil from South America as well.
Oil shale. Extraction.
Right. And so, so we have the ability to both drill deeper than we did before, although obviously with some problems, i.e. the Gulf.
Fracking,
which is obviously, I mean, it's, I guess it's not, I shouldn't say obviously, because they're allowed to do it despite the fact that it's making people's water burst into flames as it comes out of their pipes. So that there's really no pressure on oil right now for the next, say, 50 years we had a moment where there was this idea of scarcity, and that
the end of oil and all
right, that. The end of oil and all that, but it's just not peak, you know, these ideas of peak oil clearly aren't coming true, you know?
This
oil production is up. In certain
well, also
parts
because of the recession, there's been less demand for oil.
Less demand, and then
people haven't been driving as much either because they can't afford to. Or
yeah, I don't know about the numbers.
The spike
of that
in gas prices. I call it a conspiracy on that.
Right.
Spike in gas prices right before the election.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what causes this. I don't know what causes that market fluctuation. I mean, I think Iran...
Pure evil?
You know, Iran's oil production, you know, the stuff that's going on in the Middle East with Iran is definitely impacting oil production. They have... no one's buying their oil right now, just China and...
Well, there's an embargo.
There's an embargo, so they're overproducing. They have to keep extracting or their wells will stop working properly. So then now they're in a situation where they're storing tons and tons of oil. I guess Saudi Arabia is increasing its production to compensate for the oil that Iran's not able to put on the market. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's caused the recent rise. Although I saw a headline, saying that it's going to come back down. I think gas should be like $8 a gallon. I mean, I think we should, or 10, you know. There could be some major changes that would need to take place in order
you
for that
run
not
for
to be
office
just,
on that
topic. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I think you know, it's so subsidized, and it doesn't. It just. It also feels like artificially priced, right? I mean, the government has a say in how we tax it and all that stuff. And I don't know. I just feel like it should be more expensive. I think there should be congestion pricing in cities as well. I think public transportation should be free, and if not free, at least dramatically improved and less expensive.
We're in this insane cycle with public transit right now where it's chronically underfunded and and they fill gaps by increasing the price of tickets.
Right.
So they pass it on to fare users, which
right.
De-incentivizes transit use and compounds the problem.
Right. And you know, the other thing that just occurred to me, and this is, it seems like we're at conflict in some ways because... You know, the auto industry is an important earner for the American economy in multiple ways, both in terms of like how it produces, who it employs, and also just what the revenues of car sales does for the American economy. And so there's that article that talked about the millennial generation is less of an ownership generation. It's more of a, you know, so they're using car sharing services like Zipcar, et cetera, City Car Share, all that stuff. Lyft, although Lyft sounds like it's getting the boot from what you said. And then like not buying houses, renting, and not buying cars. And that they talked about the sort of the negative impact of that. You know, our economy is based on consuming to such a large extent.
And obsolescence.
And so when people stop
consuming... Because you can't transition the auto industry to making subway cars or light rail.
Right.
Because those fucking things last
way
40
too long.
Years.
Right, totally.
40, 50 years.
Yeah.
Although I guess, like, BART is, you know, I'm to the point where I just, like, you know, I'm going to start saying rosaries when I take BART under the bay.
Oh, really?
I just feel like
it's,
yeah, that thing is 40 plus years old.
Uh-huh.
And there's something weird about the way transit is, you know, transit funding functions in this country. And that, like, there's always money for expansion into the suburbs for BART.
Right.
But there's virtually no money for upkeep or maintenance.
Right.
To the point where, like, I mean, it was maybe 10 years ago there was a big fire in the Transbay Tunnel.
Right, I remember.
And they found that, like, one of the main, like, high-voltage lines through that thing had been, like coupled together. During construction, somebody had accidentally cut it with a saw or something. And,
right.
And they did a temporary patch with, like, a mountain of electrical tape and shit.
Right.
And 30 years later, it got on fire.
Surprise!
It was like, how many little things like that?
Right. The irony of that is, like, you can't. You know, if you do something in your house or, like, you try to open up a business, like, the hoops you have to jump through to be up to code is incredible. But,
yeah,
you know,
right, once you start opening stuff up.
Right.
So, meanwhile, I'll just say with BART on Saturday, which was the day of Fleet Week. What was going on inside? It's Fleet Week, there was a Cal game, the Giants game, the Niners game, Burning Man Deep Compression, Hardly Strictly Bluegrass in the Park. It was the Castro Street Fair. And it was also one other thing.
Mises Baby Shower.
Mises Baby Shower. That was the tipping point.
Yeah.
It was over a million riders. It broke a record.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
The highest usage of BART in a single day in the history of that transit service.
It's so funny. I had to go in. Bam, there it is. And you know what? And that was beautiful because it made my drive into the city so nice. It was not, I didn't hit any traffic at all. It was gorgeous. It was so great. I was like, I should take my bike. Actually, I had this problem. I went to go get my, I was like, all right, screw it. I'm going to be Anthony Ryan for a minute.
Yeah.
I'm going to ride to the MacArthur BART station. I'm going to BART over. And I'm going to ride over to this baby shower. And so I go out to my garage and like, it looks like someone slashed my tires, although that's not possible. But my tire just like the rubber just blew out, so I was like, "Shit, I gotta." I guess I can walk.
Maintain that shit.
I do. I need to go. I need to go. I've been thinking about riding my bike to Kalaa actually from home. So I guess my new commute would be to get up at 5, drive to the studio in San Francisco, drive home at noon instead of 12:30, and then ride my bike from my house to Kalaa and back.
That seems cumbersome.
It does, doesn't it? But it would be. Be less driving and more riding.
That's true. It's not convenient to get here from BART.
No, it's not.
Yeah, unless you like.
Seems like there's a lot of places that's not convenient for BART.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other.
That's a whole other thing.
I'm very curious to look at. I just found this guy on Twitter who is writing about transit, and he's got all these posts. This is not very well researched, but he's talking about basically the sort of like crazy overlaid, like redundant nature of Bay Area public transit.
Hmm.
And like the fact that like the main public transit line, I don't know if you've been paying attention, if you don't ride Caltrain, you probably wouldn't know, but never Caltrain has been experiencing these like chronic delays.
Mm-hmm.
And the past week, it's, like, reached critical mass, like, where they've had, like, massive delays every day. And it's stuff where, like, people just drive on the tracks. Like, the gate comes down, they drive around it, abandon their car. Like, that happened.
What?
People are constantly walking in front of the
those fast-moving, that train? What?
Some of them are suicides. Remember that case where down in Palo Alto, all these high school students
were
committing suicide in front of the Caltrain?
No.
There was another thing. So my wife takes Caltrain. So
she really knows. Yeah.
And there was also down in San Jose the other day, there was a police action where this high-speed chase turned into a foot chase of the suspect on the Caltrain's tracks. So they shut down the whole system.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. Because Caltrain, it's the old Southern Pacific line. So it's all street level. Tons of crossings, easy access, you know, tons of, like, gaps in the access, like, for, you know, people can just get on the tracks very easily. And
it's funny, I always see that at 16th and 7th, the intersection of 16th Street and 7th Avenue, where the Caltrain books through under the, like, on your way from the Mission to, that's Potrero area, it's by USF right there. I'm always impressed by how, the train
not
just...
Not 7th Avenue.
7th Street, sorry, you're right.
16th
Avenue. Sorry, I get streets and avenues confused. But that train just, I get caught there all the time getting down 16th from the Mission.
Mm.
And I'm just continually impressed by how fast that train blazes by.
Yeah.
Just, 2 seconds.
Yeah. They have express trains.
That thing flies.
The baby bullet.
Yeah. That thing flies. It's awesome.
Yeah, and it's big.
It is.
Yeah, trains are awesome.
Yeah. Well, I think so. So there's been constant delays and
plus
so
it's diesel.
Right.
It's never been converted to electric.
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous. And then they're building this freaking central.
The new subway. Transportation hub on 3rd there?
They're building a goddamn subway between Caltrain Station and basically Chinatown.
Right.
I don't know. It just seems crazy to me.
So it's like a double redundancy?
Subways are really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just seems utterly nutty to me.
Would you go above ground or on surface streets?
I don't know. I would put that money towards something else, like another BART line or something.
Right. Yeah, it just seems like you could connect BART to a lot more neighborhoods.
BART should go down, like...
That just seems like the answer to me.
It should go to Silicon Valley, for one.
Yeah. It should go to the Sunset, right?
It should go to the Sunset. Or very least it should. But even, like, the light rail, like, is slow as shit. Like...
Right.
If you take the... There's, like, the N. Judah line, right?
Right.
That serves the outer avenues. And in the morning, they have a goddamn express bus for the N. Judah to bypass the light rail because it's so slow. And
you can just like
nuts.
Walk faster than all that stuff.
I know.
Is it pedestrians that are making it slow? What makes
it
slow?
I don't really know. I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, one day I was coming from the East Bay and I tried to take Muni down here. On the train, and there was a game at Pac Bell Park, and it literally took. I think I eventually just got off and started walking,
right,
out of pure frustration. But
right,
it literally, because of all the pedestrians around there, they have to go super slow, and for some reason they hold up all the trains. I think it's because it gets gridlocked from traffic coming off the highway.
Right. Well, what happens is those people stream, you know, you get like this, the pedestrians don't
And they're
stop.
All suburbanites, so they have no idea how to negotiate city streets.
Right. So they just, it just causes this constant, it's not even like it's a trickle a lot of times where you get like the same thing where there's like 5 feet or 4 feet in between every person.
But
so
we were stuck on King Street for like half an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And it's not like you're at the stop with the doors open. I seriously started getting claustrophobic.
Right.
This is insane.
Let me out of this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's not. I think we were going to meet that day. You were super late. I remember you were texting me.
Yeah. I was losing my mind.
Yeah.
Never do that again.
No. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have
Market Urbanism is the guy.
Okay, we'll put a link up on that. So I wanted to, if we can circle back to pedestrians real quick.
Sorry.
No. It's good. So the California Vehicle Code 21950 states that the driver of a vehicle shall yield the right of way to a pedestrian crossing the roadway within a marked crosswalk or within an unmarked crosswalk at an intersection, except as otherwise provided in this chapter. This section does not relieve a pedestrian from the duty of due care for his or her personal safety. No pedestrian may suddenly leave a curb or other place of safety and walk or run into the path of a vehicle that is so close as to constitute an immediate hazard. No pedestrian may unnecessarily stop or delay traffic while in the marked or unmarked crossway. What do you think of that? What do you think of Section B? You weren't listening.
Oh, that's strong stuff. Well, I've heard it before.
All right, I'll get off of it. It just drives me fucking nuts, man. It just does.
This is the itch you can't scratch.
I can't scratch it. But do you think so? Like, what if there was a campaign? You know, like stop walking. Like people may. I don't think people just know. Like what I was saying with Amanda. Like she's trying to take the turn. The countdown gets to zero. She's gonna go, and this guy starts running across the street at like 1 or 2 seconds left in that countdown. And he gives her the mean mug and points to the crosswalk, saying like, "I have 2 seconds to cross the street." And she's like, "You know, no, you don't. You're supposed to have stopped walking." It's like, do you think if that guy knew?
There's the law, and then there's just like the situation,
right?
Like, what? So
I mean, I'm not saying cars have the right.
She doesn't get to just run him over.
Right. It is like there is an asymmetry there, I stipulate. But to run in front of a car and be self-righteous about it is incorrect. Right?
That's a dick move. I can't really say that I would be above that dick move.
Running in front of the car.
Yeah, and maybe acting all self-righteous.
But you get angry too when you're driving. I think that's part of the reason you don't drive so much, is you get angry at other cars and people. I mean...
I get annoyed with pedestrians. Yeah. When they're waiting out in the street to cross.
Yeah.
It's like, get out of the fucking street.
Right.
Like, have a little self-preservation.
If self-preservation is an
instinct
thing that you possess.
You don't think I possess it?
No, I think you do. I mean, I think
I'm very, I had my accident, but I'm very cautious as a pedestrian. Because, like, I'm, and we've talked this about this before, too, like, and this kind of, like, came from this book, Traffic, that I read.
Right, I've read it, too. You recommended it, and it was really great. We'll Tom Vanderbilt.
We'll link to that up. But there's the aspect of walking as a pedestrian where basically you, even though you have a walk signal, it's also legal for cars to take a left across your path of travel or a right across your path of travel.
Right.
And in both instances, the drivers, their speed and visibility is limited. In the case of the left-hand turn, they're having the difficulty of, which is the, probably the hardest thing to do with a car, is to judge the speed of oncoming traffic in order to make a left-hand turn.
Right.
The last thing on their mind is the fact that, that
there's a guy coming.
That there are people in the crosswalk as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I also talked about this, the design of modern cars with a slipping windshield and the pillar, the windshield pillar to the left of the driver is seriously obscures their view.
Yeah.
And there have been, you know, at least two cases I'm aware of in this town. I'm sure there are more where pedestrians have just been mowed down by drivers taking left-hand turns. The other aspect is drivers taking a right-hand turn across the pedestrian's path of travel where, you know, the curb the curbs are designed, they're rounded.
To make it easier.
To make it easier for cars to basically not slow down when they take that right-hand turn. I'm gesturing a left-hand turn while I do that, but take a right-hand turn. So, like, when I'm crossing a when I'm crossing a a crosswalk, I look over the shoulder. I look over my, I look over my left shoulder first, and I scan the, as someone who's been hit by a car from out of nowhere.
Yeah,
like I'm super cautious about that.
Right,
and if cars, come up on me and like physically like intimidate me with their, their proximity, I will like glare that person down.
Right.
I'll look right at the driver.
You know, it's funny. That reminds me
I'm
of
I'm walking here.
Yeah, I'm walking over
Rats
here.
Rats of Rizzo style.
Don't murder me.
And Sarah points out how, like, you know, it's illegal to jaywalk, but oftentimes you're safer crossing in the middle of the intersection.
Right.
Because both of those scenarios I just described are not at play.
Right. Yeah, no, that's right. So this book,
So maybe crosswalks should only be in the center of the intersection. What do you think of that?
I think that that...
In the center of the block.
I think that's a terrible idea. Because then, you're gonna that will just stop. Like if there, if you
no
have
crosswalks
to stop,
at the intersection, only in the middle of the block,
it just moves the problem halfway up the street.
It's safer for pedestrians.
Yeah, maybe. I have to give that some thought. So there's this book, The Invisible Gorilla, where he talks. So it's by Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons, and they talk about basically. The title of the book comes from a study they did where they asked people to watch a video and the there were people in red outfits and blue outfits on a basketball court. And the people in the basketball court, you may have heard this, they were like either passing, you know, there's probably 15 people in both colored outfits, passing a ball, a basketball to each other, or bounce passing a ball, so either air passing or bounce passing. And the participants were asked to count the air passes of the red team. Or maybe it was the blue team, but either way. Just so basically they had to ignore everybody in the blue in one color outfit, and then of that group, ignore all the bounce passes and only count the air passes, right?
And they had like a little counter in their hand or
something? Yeah, right. And so halfway through, I guess the video is like a minute long, halfway through somebody comes out in a gorilla suit, stands in the middle of the court and beats their chest for like, 60 seconds or something like that.
Sounds and, like a Kentucky Fried movie.
And then, so then like a very low, like 50% of participants see the gorilla. Another 50% of them don't. And so they're trying to say like, well, what is that? How does that, how do you explain that? And so this attention blindness, they talk about it in terms of traffic where motorcyclists say, you know, I was coming, I saw this car, I made eye contact with the lady driving, and then she just plowed into me.
Because they weren't looking for a gorilla.
They were looking, like what you say, when you're trying to make that left turn across traffic, you're looking for cars, you're not looking for pedestrians, and you're not looking for motorcycles. Mm-hmm. And so, like this idea that a motorcyclist would wear a bright reflective vest,
doesn't even matter.
Like they should have like two headlights or something like that look like a car, not a motorcycle. Now it sort of defeats the purpose of being a narrow motorcycle, but it's this fascinating failure of human perception. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, you know, we always attribute, like, you know, you said dick move, whatever, and I actually was accused of being a dick by another motorist the other day.
Wow, what'd you do?
Oh, I took a left onto a street where, you know, where you get up on 280 behind this, the studio there, like from 26th or whatever. Anyway, traffic was kind of backed up, so
that
I took...
That four-way stop up there?
That four-way stop, where people get off the highway, and some people are trying to get on the highway, and so I was...
We'll have a link to Google View, Street View.
You can make the call. And so I... you know, I went to take, you know, I waited for like three, past my turn like two or three times, and basically the people going straight were just taking my spot. So I just swung out wide and cut in, and the guy yelled like, "Dick move, nowhere to go," because he was going the opposite direction.
Right.
So I that traffic was moving fine, and I really wasn't actually blocking him for more than 2 seconds. But anyway. I just think people are like, oh, what? You could get shot here.
Segue, maybe. Is that a word?
Segue? It is a good word.
It's not those things people ride around to.
It's also a segue.
I thought it was a Segue.
I think it's pronounced Segue as well. I think it's just spelled differently.
Yeah. Remember Sedgefield jeans?
Don't know what you're
the
talking
about. Physical fit?
No, what are you talking about?
Oh, and they had this great commercial. It was like late 70s where the guy was like on a, the like gymnast horse.
Oh yeah, pommel
horse, and he was like in this pair of jeans and a karate,
top.
Gi, thank you, yeah. Top. Yeah, Sedgefield jeans. I had a pair of Sedgefield jeans.
Did you look hot in them?
I did not have blonde curly hair and a matching mustache. Unfortunately,
too bad. No pommel horse time. This is like that movie.
Sedgefield jeans with a physical fit.
Did that come out after Gymkhana? Remember that movie?
Oh, no, this is seriously, like, late 70s.
Well, right, that was Gymkhana. Well, I think Gymkhana came out in the 80s. Remember the men's gymnastics team? And it was, like...
Don't look it up.
I gotta look
it up. I remember Gymkhana. I thought it was a good segue to the Google car.
Oh, yeah. The self-driving cars. So that's going to solve everything.
So, like, here's the problem. You have the average citizens, which, let's face it, 99% of them are total assholes and idiots. Maybe 85. I'll say 85%. Like, who have no business operating
any kind of vehicle
with that level of destructive power.
Let alone with a cell phone.
So, like, let's just stop making them operators of these lethal machines.
Uh-huh.
And either put them in public transit or have a computer that's smarter than them to drive the car.
Right. I think that's, I mean, you know, like...
And also in the age of distraction.
Right.
So I mentioned this. I had a period where I was renting cars and borrowing cars. So I was driving more than usual.
Right.
And I look around, everybody's texting.
Yeah.
While they're driving.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
So, like, in this age of everybody obsessed with the little gigaw in their hand, and I'm just as guilty as everyone else.
Uh-huh.
Why do I never hear this? Like, on public transit, you can use your little gigaws all the live long day. Your iPads and your Androids.
Except they'll get stolen. You know, that's happening where guys are, like, jumping on when the doors open, they come on and grab your phone out of your hand.
I have never heard or seen this, and I read me all the time.
Right. Actually, anyway. I just heard this could be apocryphal.
Yeah.
It happened at a Starbucks in Oakland the other day. I was standing out there. Some guy.
So what's the lesson? Don't go to Starbucks. We already knew that.
You have so many prohibitions.
But anyway, here's my point.
Uh-huh.
Public transit, you can watch a movie on your iPhone or iPad or
Fire
or whatever.
That's right.
And all this stuff you can't do in the car. Productive time.
Right.
So This also gets into the...
I saw a guy reading a book in his car while he was driving.
Was he, stop-and-go traffic?
It was stop-and-go traffic, and then it was not stop-and-go traffic, and he continued to read his book.
Yeah, I've seen...
It's horrendous.
Yeah.
The things that we do... I mean, I'm guilty of doing several things. You know, I do lots of things behind the wheel.
Yeah.
But
you know, people...
I don't read a book.
People that drive, really long commutes every day, mm-hmm. I think become... Totally inured
to the fact that they're, driving a death machine.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm all for the Google self-driving cars. I think Jerry...
What was your take on them? So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I've been, reading about adaptive cruise control for a long time. So adaptive cruise control is available now, and basically you set your speed and then it uses lasers and other things and sonar or whatever... to measure the speed of the cars in front of you and then automatically slows down in response to that and then speeds up.
Is this
up.
On really high-end cars?
I mean, it is. It started out in high-end cars, and I think it's becoming more stock. I mean, mm-hmm. I think this is what happens in the auto industry, that things become, they go into the high-end mm-hmm. stuff and then become, sort of available in your Ford, entry-level Ford cars.
Mm-hmm.
So adaptive cruise, if every car had adaptive cruise control, for example, you could, that traffic, the accordioning that happens when someone slams on their brakes would sort of would theoretically go away. Now, of course.
It's almost like, it reminds me of, have you ever seen CHP actively regulate traffic
mm-hmm.
to prevent bottlenecks?
Oh, when
I've seen on CSP when they do the weave.
Yeah.
Now,
is that why they do that? I've always, the times that I've seen that, there's been, a mattress on the mile highway or a ladder or something like that, and they're stopping traffic to get to remove
I've
something.
Had it happen down 101 North on the way to, Richmond San Rafael Bridge. I mm-hmm. think they're preventing a situation where people are suddenly going 80
right.
and confront, a dead stop.
Right.
I think that's what
interesting, yeah.
It's a similar thing to what you're talking about.
Right.
But it also promotes... more efficient use of the vehicle now.
Right.
Yeah.
Hold on, what? Prevent?
Well, in other words, people drive, again, idiots, jackrabbits starts, mm-hmm. and abrupt stops, so, you do it all the time, just floor it for a single block when they can see the goddamn red light right there.
Right.
Yeah. Really, this is bad for the mechanics of the car, but also really inefficient.
Right.
In terms of
gas
consumption. This would make the gas consumption more efficient too. Right?
Gas consumption would get more efficient. So now, what Google has achieved is actually pretty phenomenal. Because not too long ago, I don't remember. It's like the X Prize, but DARPA would put on this competition for self-driving vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Had been doing it for years and years and years. And I remember there was a Pathfinder out of MIT or some, one of those kind of research-based schools that had achieved their wildest dreams at that time, which is just a short distance course. It could navigate through a course based, on its internal sensor package. But I mean, it was just it was an insane amount of computing in this car and not foolproof. I mean, it mm-hmm. did a lot of bad. But computing power obviously has changed, and so has, so you can pack a lot more sensors. Sensors are more sophisticated now, all that stuff. So now the car, they've driven thousands of miles on California roads unassisted. I think there were two, I think in that article it said that there were just two.
And it was the fault of the other driver.
It was right, exactly. Somebody else. It wasn't the car. It was that they had to just kind of slam on the brakes.
Mm-hmm.
But they are... they currently have technology in cars that you can drive your car at full speed towards a wall. These avoidance systems that you can get it in a Lexus now, basically, mm-hmm. and it will
That's
prevent
a rush,
you.
Huh?
It will prevent you. It'll auto brake. It'll prevent you from smashing. I don't think
there's some culture of people doing this.
Just totally testing there. That would be quite a test, right? Mm-hmm. It would make action movies less believable in the future, though, right? Like you can't crash a car in an action movie.
They don't have to be period films.
Exactly, they'll stop being believable at some point.
Mm-hmm.
That's funny. The implications of self-driving cars in action movies.
You have this plot device where right. maybe that
you could, there's an override. Right, right. Yeah. Totally.
Sensor deactivated.
crash. The so anyway, I mean, the technology is available. I mean, there's lots of problems with it, obviously. Number one being everyone who's got a car now can't just go out and buy a self-driving car, right? Like, mm-hmm. you could have, if when the percentages of self-driving cars to human-driven cars is, you know, 1 to 100 or 1 to 1,000 or whatever the number is, you know, that ratio has to change dramatically in order for you to start seeing major improvements in traffic flow. Now, for the individual drivers, it's going to be a lot nicer. It's mm-hmm. like it's your computerized chauffeur, and you really can read a book. While it's doing it, especially in stop-and-go traffic in like known routes, you know, like the
route. It's good for those people that like recline all the way back in their seats.
Totally. Where, like, yeah.
They basically can't see anything.
But you know, it's funny. It's like people, it just occurred to me that like people don't want to buy e-readers because they like the feel of books. How many people are going to not, they're going to be like, well, I like to drive, you know, I like the feeling of being in control of my vehicle and like that, you know, like if people are so unwilling to just try an electronic, like to try a Kindle to read a book versus picking up a book, the adoption on a self-driving car, I wonder if that would be, if they made self-driving cars free, I wonder if people would take them or not.
Or I wonder if it's going to be a different model altogether, if it's mm-hmm. going to have to start, like, obviously the cabbies would have a problem with this. This might see a lift.
Right.
But like,
so self-driving cabs.
Well, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
Just have an app where you're just like, I need a ride. Bloop, mm-hmm. bloop, bloop.
Yep. And then the
car. There's a self-driving car.
And the car would actually know where to go.
Take me. Bloop, bloop, bloop.
Right.
Once it drops you off, it just goes to the nearest next person that needs it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all proximity.
That would be the best way to adopt that.
Right. Probably.
That would be weird, wouldn't it?
It would be awesome.
A robot car pulling up to the curb.
Yeah.
Opening the door for you.
Yeah. Ding. I'm ready. I'm ready for that day.
It's practically a jetpack.
It's practically a jetpack. That's right.
Vernon Reed.
Yeah, that was so great.
I forget how he said it.
Well, he was saying like I'm a Jetsons. The promise of the Jetsons.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed. I want my jetpack. You know what's funny about that?
I
want my teleporter. You know what's funny is like we can barely manage. Like if you think about driving on a city street, like all the tension that happens at surface level.
Mm.
Can you imagine just like adding a third dimension to that? Right. It just would be pandemonium. Like flying cars and jetpacks. That will never ever fucking happen because everyone will just die. Like we can't follow the road to cross. Pedestrians can't follow the road to cross the street, and drivers can't follow the rules to turn off the street.
You know, we're being so fatalistic about this, but like, actually, when you consider how many cars are out there,
it's pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing that like, relatively,
we're complaining about,
especially
hours
in a city.
Yeah,
like my brother-in-law is he's basically a paramedic, which is now a firefighter. I have to say, fireman. To piss off my feminist sister-in-law.
Always got to get someone's goat.
Yeah, we always got to say. No, my wife was saying this the other day. Yeah, I say fireman on purpose because I know she'll always correct me and say firefighter.
Right.
But he mentioned like, yeah, as a paramedic in San Francisco, which he's been for close to 20 years, he never has to deal with car wrecks, really. Mm-hmm. Rarely.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly picking up drunks.
Right.
Because you just don't have that many car wrecks in the city.
Right.
It's out in places. Like, he used to be a paramedic.
No one can drive fast enough to have
out on 395.
Right.
You know, like, and he was talking about it like, oh, yeah, that's more exciting to respond to a car crash.
Yikes.
So, sounds pretty awful to me, but whatever.
Well, I mean, I guess your benchmark gets changed when you're doing that kind of work.
Yeah, yeah. He's got stories. But he's also said something interesting to me once, like, you know, people are going to die less and less in car crashes. It's like the design of cars is much safer, and even, like, freeway abutments and dividers and everything are designed
To absorb the
shock. To absorb the shock or minimize damage. But people are still dying. Tens of thousands of people are still dying on highways every year.
Yeah, when everybody asks.
It's something I still can't get my mind around. It's like, there's a Vietnam on the highways every year.
It's crazy to think about it like that. Yeah, when everybody, this is not to underplay
the effect of 9/11,
right?
Or so it was a horrific tragedy, but like when you consider that loss of life, which was well under 4,000, I guess, precipitated the sea change in our culture and $5 billion or $5 trillion war, whatever the price tag is up to at this point. Wars, and but we just kind of accept.
Surprised you're doing business, getting possibly killed in a car.
Well, plus we don't notice things that we lose in attrition,
Right. Like, yeah, I mean, if
it's not singular, a singular event, we don't notice.
If we had,
I was going to mention earlier, I don't know in what context, but if people actually thought about Obama's tax cuts, the middle class, they'd realize that their payroll tax had been reduced. Where it's something like the average person is paying like $2,000 to $3,000 less on their payroll tax than they were. But if you ask people, they would say, no, Obama never cut my taxes.
Right.
But if they ask, oh, did George Bush cut your taxes? Oh, yeah, I got a check for $600.
Right. So it's like the difference between a passive and active cut, right?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe your point about cars is like if there was a 2-hour period once a year when 10,000 people would die and you didn't know what, in their cars. It was a 2-hour period.
Talk about Carmageddon.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that would be a crazy day, right? But the fact that it happens.
50,000 car pile up.
But just, it would have to happen all over the country simultaneously, right? In order to be equivalent, right? In order for it to register in the national psyche,
I guess.
Yeah, I think. Well, I don't even think.
There's all those.
Well, and I always laugh, when someone asks me when I go surfing, they're like, aren't you afraid of getting bitten by a shark? It's like, I have the chances of being bitten by a shark, or I have a greater chance of dying on my way to go surfing than I do surfing, right?
Is that true?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's been only 10 shark attacks in the last 10 years. Fatal. There's been one or two fatal shark attacks on the West Coast in the last 10 years. And they just don't. They do kill you.
Mm-hmm.
They fuck you up for sure. There's been more tastings, more great whites have tasted people than killed them, but they live.
Surfer tastings.
This neoprene tastes disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a neoprene
sausage.
How would you describe wine? When you this is neoprene finish and undertones of
hemoglobin.
Hemoglobin and THC, probably.
Right. Totally.
It's a little skunky.
It's a little skunky indeed, right?
Notes of skunky.
Skunky Mendo. But more people die driving to the beach than they do drown, right? Or whatever the number is. But I'm very conscious of that when I'm thinking, when I'm driving out to do something dangerous that does seem like driving is more dangerous. Yeah, that Tom Vanderbilt book was really great. I think if you read the Tom Vanderbilt book in conjunction with The Invisible Gorilla, you'd have a real sense of both the technical aspects of traffic and driving, and then you'd have the the human perceptual problems of driving as well. Mm-hmm. Pretty fascinating. I just want to see if we can wrap up our discussion here and close back a loop that I was thinking about earlier, which is the not in my backyard attitude that takes place in San Francisco. Prevents high rises from being built that would allow basically for.
We're not even talking about high rises.
I'm not even necessarily talking about high rises, but I'm just thinking high density housing, which essentially, at some level, it's not necessarily a high rise, but it's rises higher than San Francisco's are currently allowing things to be built.
I don't think that's true, actually.
I believe it is.
I think some of the housing. You're not talking about the downtown residential.
No, obviously, downtown residential high-rises is different, but, like, basically...
Like, in my neighborhood, there's plenty of, like, pre-war buildings that are...
Well, I wouldn't say that there's plenty. They're large. They're not plenty of them, because obviously...
There's a smattering.
There's a smattering, but saying,
but there's
like...
there's a precedent.
Like, there is a precedent, for sure. The article that I'm talking about, either it's a podcast or an article, I don't remember what it was saying. I mean, I don't remember where I read it, and I'll have to dig it up and I'll figure that out, because it's a good article. But basically they're saying that, you know, San Francisco wants to be really progressive in all these areas, but people don't want... The reason real estate is so expensive is because there's a height limit and a density, which is effectively a density limit, which is... causes prices to rise.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the problem with San Franciscans, and, you know, I don't know that it's necessarily just San Franciscans, but that, you know, they're people are operating from their personal perspective, right? So it's like you say your conjecture that the people in that 6-unit building that don't want a big building built in that lot next to them is just going to ruin their southern exposure, right? Same thing. So you have to overcome that, your desire for your own personal satisfaction or whatever that mindset is, in order to make San Francisco a better place that makes it affordable to people with lower income. So if you want diversity, which is going to mean a variety of socioeconomic stratus,
I don't even think you have to be that altruistic in your thinking. Mm-hmm. I think you can just be like, you know, higher density is just
it's better
right. for the society.
It's better for the society, for the environment, for everything. Right. So, but I think it's like that perspective. So it's the same perspective that when you're a pedestrian, you're self-righteous about cars, and when you're a driver, you know, it's a perspective problem, basically, is what it comes down to. When you're driving, you expect to be able to just go. You don't, anything that's in your way, including other cars, but especially bicycles and pedestrians, you don't respect and you want them out of your fucking way. When you're a pedestrian or when you're a bicyclist, you're self-righteous about your perspective in there. And when you're a homeowner in San Francisco, you want whatever it is that makes you feel like you have a good house or a good living situation. So to live in a single family dwelling or whatever it is in San Francisco is much more attractive for you as an individual than to be an apartment dweller, whether it's a 6-unit building or a 60-unit building.
Mm-hmm.
My argument is if you had a lot more 60-unit buildings in San Francisco, you could support, and that's just an arbitrary number. I don't know what the sweet spot is. I don't think
60 units.
60. I'm just picking a number. But so
well,
maybe
even
40.
Like
20. But
buildings like my building's on a double lot,
right?
And it's got 12 residential units,
right?
So there's 12 units on a double lot,
right?
So that's 6 units per lot,
right?
And there's a commercial unit on the ground floor. So
right.
Let's say 6 units plus commercial on the lot versus the more typical 2 units,
right,
per lot.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so tripling the number of people in a building or quadrupling it in that situation would make housing a lot more affordable in the Mission, for example, mm-hmm. right? So,
I don't know that
I'm
that
not
would
necessarily
happen, actually.
Well, just look at Brooklyn and
but
Manhattan,
just,
you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, I mean, housing's expensive there because despite the fact that they have huge capacity, there's a lot of people want to live in those places, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially Manhattan. But, you know, the cities that they're building in China right now, they're doing some experimental, they're building experimental cities that are, you know, optimized for being both green and incredibly dense. And so, you know, building it with, you know, with green infrastructure, gray water reclamation, and then I don't know what the numbers are, and I'll look this up, but, you know, the optimal number of people living in a per block radius with the kinds of services that you would need, you know, grocery stores and that kind of stuff. So they're really just like taking this opportunity from whole cloth to build a city. And so it'll be a really great experiment. Let's build these cities that will be optimized for, lowering the impact on the environmental impact, increasing, you know, transportation, ease of access, all that stuff. It'd be really fascinating to see what happens. But I do put forth that San Francisco would be more affordable. There would be more affordable housing if people were willing to build, to allow slightly larger buildings, residential buildings to be created.
Yeah, it's possible.
And so I think just
I don't know enough about the issue. Like, are right. there a lot of? It seems to me that a lot of there are a lot of multi-unit dwellings getting built.
Depends on the neighborhood.
Yeah,
depends on the neighborhood, and
I'd like to see more.
Yeah, you know, like, yeah. No, I just think, but I think it just to tie it all together. I mean, I think that we have just like this, you know, perspective problem that we're going to need to, as a society, need to get over in order to move forward. And I think it's happening to a degree. It happens incrementally, but it needs to, you know, I think there needs to be some focus on this.
Well, I think there's also, like, there's an obsession with sort of controlling your environment.
Right.
That as a city dweller, you
optimizing your environment for yourself, right?
Yeah. I think as a city dweller, you just have to get over.
Right.
It's just like, and it's always trade-offs, right? So, mm-hmm. like,
So you have to make the benefits need to be increased. In order to make it, you know, you need to continually improve the public space, which arguably we're not doing with the privatization of bus routes out of from San Francisco to Silicon Valley and all these things. That's the, you know, your argument being, and I think it's a totally valid one, that, you know, if Google and Facebook and all the people that have these private bus routes that take, you know, citizens of San Francisco to Silicon Valley every day, invested that money or more money into public transportation that would make that trip from San Francisco to Silicon Valley more pleasant for everybody. And then that would just, you know, raise everyone's boats up as well.
Float everyone's boats. Yeah. And I think what I was going to say earlier in relation to that and relation to the Twitter thing, I think, and this is the hardest thing to do in the world is to get governmental entities that have like multi that have jurisdiction over like more than one county.
Right.
Right. So like
to broker a peace between San Francisco and Silicon Valley. To make it
well,
so that,
like, or you have like a Bay Area transit district
mm-hmm.
that looks at the big picture, and instead of having all these redundant or overlaying
right
sort of transit systems,
yeah,
they become more unified,
right?
You know, so there's a master plan for the mm-hmm. whole thing.
Master plan,
yeah. BART was a stab mm-hmm. at that, mm-hmm. you know, and like, I guess I'm talking about something like. In New York and New Jersey, you have the mm-hmm. You have the Port Authority,
right?
So they have authority over, you know, these multiple jurisdictions,
and, right?
You know, there have been a lot of abuses in that realm, but
right.
like that's like one of the hardest things to do, as right. evidenced by like the difficulty in getting anything built
right.
at Ground Zero, which they're finally doing
mm-hmm.
11 years down the road,
right. Well, that makes me think about like the, and we're going to wrap this up, but I just wonder about the high-speed rail, but you know, that's slated between San Francisco and LA, but it's not even going to make it to LA, right? Isn't it stopping north of LA? Like, who wants to go to Bakersfield, wherever it is?
Yeah, they inevitably do. They take these funding shortcuts
right.
that end up just like completely defeating the entire purpose.
Yeah.
Like, if the purpose is.
To create
the
a
advantage
corridor.
Of a high-speed rail uh-huh. in Europe is an example because that's
right.
the model that everybody wants to go after, or even
right.
Japan.
Japan
is that
yeah.
you can get on a train in a city center,
go to another city
go
center,
to another city center,
right?
Yeah. So like that is an advantage over wow. airline travel because
right.
airline travel necessitates having to travel to this facility that's outside of the city center,
right?
Waited along security lines, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, so, like, if you can do an end run around that.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, by stopping in, I don't know what the hell they're doing. They're, like,
starting
in Santa Clarita and all this.
Right.
Totally just making it not.
Just bizarre.
Yeah.
Just bizarre.
Well, you know, Republicans hate high-speed rail. Yeah.
Which is also bizarre. Like, what's wrong with... like, what's their ideological problem with it? They don't like to move quickly?
It's a governmental solution.
Right.
And it requires a governmental solution.
Right. And constituencies are going to be, you know, relocated and... You know, you're going to have, getting a rail.
Eminent domain
problems, which is a serious thing. But, you know, again, it's like.
Where is it going to go?
I don't know. I read an article about it.
I picture it just going down the I-5 corridor. That always makes sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Just like right down the median of the I-5.
I can't.
So when people are sitting in traffic, they can watch this train go by 150 miles an
hour. Totally.
And be like, huh.
I'm a moron.
Yeah.
Or they have their adaptive cruise control, and they're flying down the highway at 150 miles an hour.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, so did you know that Jerry Brown just signed a law allowing self-driving automobiles?
Yeah. Yeah, he came to the Google campus.
To sign it,
that law. No, it's great.
Google's just going to be the new
everything.
State infrastructure.
Right. Okay.
They know everything about us.
They know where we want to go before we go there.
Yeah.
And they'll... Sell us delicious food when we get to that place.
Google?
Well, you know, there's like the proximity. They'll sell to advertisers who will know where you are that will give you on-demand coupons for Chipotle when you are within 25 feet of a Chipotle or heading there. It'll text you it'll email you or text you a coupon for all the businesses that they want to promote in the destination that you're going. So, like, you'll put in your... You'll put in your destination on your map, in your Google map, and then you'll click start, and you'll start navigating, and then you'll get, like, an SMS message saying, you know, Godfather's Pizza is right there. Are you hungry?
Will it know if you're hungry?
Yeah. It should know if you're hungry.
Will it know if you're naughty or nice?
Yes. I guess it depends on what your Google, if you've got Google
search history. Been bad or good.
Yeah, your Google search history has been enabled or not. Yeah, if you're going incognito or not. But, did you notice that there's, on the new iOS 6, there's all these privacy settings now that you can get granular with how much you're being tracked, how much you're allowed to be tracked.
I think I heard about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another topic for another day?
Very good.
All right, sir. You've been listening to the Aphorist, or not listening to the Aphorist, depending. And,
the listener.
You are the listener, and we appreciate you. Stay tuned for next week. Thank you very much.